KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. In less than 10 years, my guest, John Elliott, has blown up in the world of fashion. I think more importantly, in the world of style. You sort of take the cool of DC and ethnies and sort of move into a more adult thing. That kind of energy, that's what John brings to the world. I'm wearing his jeans right now. In fact, I picked these up in San Francisco in the hate. This guy just went, oh, you're wearing Visram. Come in, I got something for you. I walked past this guy's store. He went, come in here, I got something for you. And that's how I found out about you like 3 years ago.
Wow.
And I guess the best way to put this in terms of your shoes, apparently John Elliott knows Bo better than Bo knows Bo. He wrote a letter to Nike when he was a kid telling what they need to do with Bo Jackson. I would have said he just should concentrate on one sport. But that's another conversation altogether. First of all, John, thanks so much for being here.
It's a tremendous honor. Thank you for having me.
You haven't heard the show yet. Anyway, but talk about that letter you wrote to Nike when you were a kid, man.
Yeah, no, I think it's so cool that that's become like such a big part of our story, because I think more than anything, for anyone who's listening, you know, for me at least, like having kind of a passion early on in life was hugely instrumental in helping me get here. I always was pretty focused on what I wanted to do. So, you know, from the time I was young, I was lucky.
Like DC and ethnies, were they like big influences on you, those brands?
Yeah, like all the skate brands that, like, you know, from the early 90s, like, I think not so much like even like Etnies in DC, more of like the spinoff brands, the brands that were created by skaters that, like, was their own thing, you know? So, like, backtrack like to the early 90s, mid 90s, when I was like a kid, like 7 years old in the Bay Area. You know, that was kind of like the epicenter for skateboarding culture was really San Francisco.
Does this Villain sweatshirt come from Villains from the store?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So I was born in San Francisco, grew up in the Bay Area, and like I used to, you know, make the trip to Haight Street to go shop at my favorite store, which was Villains. And it was just kind of like this incredible eclectic store that was also like a cultural kind of like just mixing, where you had like all sorts of like new styles being experimented with. And I just couldn't get enough of it. I also, like, you know, really couldn't afford everything in the store. But, you know, you try to figure out ways to get what you want. So I would identify something, work, you know, sell something, work for something, and then go in and get it. And that was kind of like my North Star was, you know, was Nike. It was skateboarding. And it was that store, Villains on Haight Street. So as soon as I graduated from college, I immediately went to that store because I knew that that was kind of, you know, what I felt most attracted to, and begged them for a job and started on the floor. And yeah, that was like probably 11, 12 years ago. So
you went straight from that to starting your own brand, basically.
Well, no, not exactly. I worked for the store for about like maybe a year and a half, 2 years, and then met some guys who were interested in kind of like starting their own store, and we partnered up and took over a store in the Marina called Jack's. And we had that. We opened up a second location downtown, and you know, I was able to take a lot of like the things that I learned on Haight Street, stylistically, brands, and just how to, you know, actually interact with customers, which was probably the most important element of like operating a proper store. And apply that to this new space, and, you know, things went really well. So I was at Jack's for, I think, like 2 or 3 years, and then got recruited by G-Star, the Dutch denim brand, to come down to L.A. and do wholesale for them. And, you know, going back to, like, what you said about Nike, like, you know, it's funny, my dad is actually here right now. And I think from the time I was a kid, I pretty much knew what I wanted to do. I like was always kind of had a different view on how I dressed and how I, like, I guess appropriated like different styles. I grew up playing basketball, but also like skateboarding.
So you your own Bo Jackson?
Yeah, well, I mean, in my brain, in my mind, I don't know if you know other people I grew up with would agree with that. However, I think the cool thing was, like, I was on this traveling basketball team where you had kids from all over different areas of the Bay Area, and they had like different life experiences, and we would practice and go to tournaments together, and I would learn about their life experiences. They would learn about mine. We would trade things like music and, you know, the way we wear clothes. We'd trade shoes sometime. And, you know, as a result, like, I had like kind of this like, I guess, broader view of like what was going on outside of like my own community in a time that was like before the internet. So I had like this kind of like, I don't know, an idea of how I wanted to dress, how I wanted to represent myself, you know, before like, I guess, everybody else, because I was on this traveling basketball team, whereas like a lot of the kids in my school were just very insular. Like it was only what was cool.
It was tribes. You wore this or you wore this.
Exactly. And so for me, it was kind of interesting to like, you know, grow up in a school that was, you know, really cool. It was like a suburban school, and like, you know, skateboarding was kind of like the thing. Like you had to be able to skate pretty well in order to be kind of cool. And so, you know, if you wanted to hang out with anyone after school, like you'd probably go skate. And if you couldn't skate well, like you probably couldn't hang out. So I needed to kind of like be able to skate well enough to hang out with the guys and, you know, and the girls that I wanted to hang out with. And also hoop at a level that was like good enough to stay on this squad. And I think as a result, like really in those formative years, you know, early like teens, like that was kind of like what set my aesthetic. And then moving to Haight Street, you know, where like that aesthetic very much like was represented as far as like just how many different cultures like converge on that street to trade ideas.
Especially in the 90s, where yeah. really was this convergence of all these cultures. You know, you start with villains from one end of the street to amoeba down at the other
end. And I think that just kind of like helped to start to shape like a little bit of a point of view. And once you have like a little bit of a point of view on like how you want to represent yourself, well, then you start to develop a little bit of a curiosity like, huh, what would it be like to actually build this myself? And that's kind of, you know, right around, I would say like 2007 was probably 2006, 2007 was like the first time that I really had like kind of like my first thought about trying to start my own thing. And I went to my dad and, you know, obviously I didn't have much money saved, and I also didn't have a business background whatsoever. And, you know, that was kind of like, okay, come back down to earth. Like, let's work through the industry a little bit more in order to give yourself an opportunity to actually succeed. Because if you're going to do this, you're probably only going to get one shot. And that was the advice that he gave me. Like, you're going to get one shot at it. So really set yourself up so that that first time you take your shot, like, you know, you have a chance of actually being able to, you know, see your dream to the at least an extent where you feel fulfilled with it. So that's where going to work for wholesale, going to work for G-Star, allowed me to view the industry through a different lens.
Wow, my guest is the Muggsy Bowes of fashion, John. It's the treatment. But that's what the story is finally got to be about, isn't it? I mean, basically trying to figure out what it is you want. I mean,
yeah.
You can't just try to sort of broadly forecast what people are going to want. It's going to be about what you want to put in out there for people to get in the first place.
Yeah, no, exactly. So, you know, to kind of like jump back on like the story arch of like how I got here. So leave G-Star and I call this gentleman, Simon Miller. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. He's like a pretty well-known denim designer and now has like, he's not a part of it anymore, but he has a line that's extremely successful. They're
Citizens,
women's. Yeah. Yes, he worked for Citizens. Yeah. Elvis, you are very well versed. But basically, he called him up. I was one of the first people that sold his line at Jax. And I said, look, you know, I've always wanted to do this. You've known that. Would it be cool if I, you know, went and apprenticed with you, basically just work for free?
Wow.
Just to kind of like learn the lay of the land in downtown LA, because downtown LA, unlike a lot of places in the world, is pretty unique in the sense that if you have a little bit of money and you have a great deal of drive and you have a car, you can really, you can get anything done. You can build denim, you could build, you know, sweatshirts, t-shirts, you could build furniture, you can build cars. I mean, you know, there's an incredible amount of creativity that is happening in downtown LA and even further south, you know, in Vernon and Compton. Like, there's an incredible amount of manufacturing and highly, highly, highly skilled workers from all over over the world. And it's kind of the Wild West. You can build anything down there. You just have to be like willing to, you know, really kind of be outside your comfort zone in certain instances and trust people and like have people kind of show you like the way. And so, you know, I went and worked for Simon for like about a year and a half, and really learned the basics of like what it takes to build a balanced denim pattern, all the way to sourcing fabrics and then finding people who could like, you know, kind of help me craft my idea, my opinion on what a guy's basic wardrobe should look like, and start to sample it. So yeah, so that was kind of like, you know, also a very challenging year financially because, you know, I wasn't really bringing in any type of income. But yeah, you know, I look back on that year as like probably the favorite year of my life. But it was also incredible because like I was working with Simon, but I also had like a point of view that was very different than Simon's. Simon has like, I would say like a very classic take on like an American approach.
It's a little glossier than yours.
Yeah. And mine, I would say, is like a little bit more street, a little bit more contemporary. And I remember he was looking at what I was building and it was funny. Like he did not think it was going to work.
Really?
Yeah, because it was different. You know, it was like, I wanted to build a look that was really for myself, you know? And so super slim jeans that would, you know, break in over time and last and, you know, could eventually, you know, hopefully be passed down to your kids with slouchy t-shirts and then really, really thick, slim sweatshirts that, again, would kind of like stretch out and like, you know, morph over time.
You got to talk about the villain sweatshirt, though.
Yeah.
That's really the thing that drew my attention to you.
Yeah. So that was really interesting because, like, you know, I'm not a formally trained designer. So, again, like, all I would ever do is, like, sit there and draw to my best abilities with an idea in mind. So one night I was sitting and, you know, sometimes inspiration comes from the most peculiar of places, but I was sitting watching YouTube videos of Joe Montana, of all people.
It's actually about your size.
Yeah, it was like, wow, he's probably a little bit bigger than me. But
he's a small guy.
Yeah. And so I was watching him in like a playoff game against like the New York Giants, just, you know, reminiscing on what it was like being a kid growing up in the Bay Area. And it was like a cold day, Candlestick in the city. And he got like just drilled by somebody and like he's picking himself up off the turf and his jersey was cut asymmetrically. So like part of his jersey covered his hand warmer. So he puts his hands into like a pocket that was concealed and you couldn't see it. And this light bulb went on for me. And I was like, I'd always wanted a crew neck because I used to ride a fixed gear bike around San Francisco. And I always wanted a crew neck hoodie that like had a kangaroo pocket so I could put my phone or my wallet, whatever, keys in there. But anytime you have a crew neck with a kangaroo pocket, it looks quite young. So this idea to do two, you know, zippers concealing the pocket so that it's clean was like kind of a really big idea. And to be honest with you, the first time I started to show people the line, I was so fearful of this sweatshirt because I felt like it was really kind of a fashion idea, you know? It was like, it was a really kind of aggressive idea at that time. So I was showing people our jeans, you know, and hoping that like what I had built with our denim program would be enough for them to pick up the line. And then I would kind of show the t-shirts and the sweatshirts secondary. And so in our first couple of appointments with, you know, buyers for a potential store, I was really like thinking that the denim was going to be like our foundation, kind of the anchor of this new idea. And I'll never forget, you know, we were able to secure a couple wholesale appointments with, you know, big stores, one of them being in New York City with Atrium. And the buyer, yeah, which was like really big for us at that time to have that opportunity to show them when we were really nothing. So, yeah, that the villain has, you know, I think since become a classic. And I when I designed it, I knew it was special. I knew it was kind of a big idea. And I wanted to pay homage to where I'm from, which is Haight Street in San Francisco, California. And that was the first store that gave me an opportunity to kind of like sharpen my sword, if you will. And yeah.
We're going to take a break. My guest, who's inspired by Joe Montana, I'm not mad at him, is John Elliott, the designer. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Okay.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? Critics rave The Greatest Hits is a music-infused romance that hits all the right notes and the most original time travel story in years. Featuring music by Nelly Furtado, Beach House, Jamie XX, and more. Watch The Greatest Hits, now streaming on Hulu.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. We're talking about villains and Joe Montana and Cold Days and Candlestick and Atrium, where I first got that sweatshirt, that villain, with the designer John Elliott. Well, first of all, let me get back to that Nike story. That's such a great story about you just writing that. What made you decide to do that?
I wish I could tell you. You know, it was so long ago. I think the letter is like postmarked from 1991. So, you know,
it was Bo Jackson. Yeah, it had to be a long time ago.
So long ago. But I think, you know, it's interesting.
But those, like, those Bo Jackson were bad.
Cheers. Yeah. Like, bad isn't cool or bad isn't bad?
Bad isn't bad.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's probably why I was motivated to write to them, you know, is
because they weren't representing him?
Well, I don't want to, you know, look, how crazy can I be? You know, I'm talking about my, like, seven-year-old self. But, you know, I think the thing was is I grew up in a non-traditional way. I'm super dyslexic. I got identified as being, like, extremely dyslexic.
When were you identified that?
I think when I was, like, in second grade, they started to realize there was something that wasn't adding up. And so, like, I just struggled with school pretty mightily. And that kind of became like a part of who I am, not in a bad way at all, like in a good way. And I think, you know, in a cool sense, like my parents were really supportive of arts and of athletics, you know, and like, and of like skateboarding.
Because that's where you expressed yourself.
Yeah, they were just like, hey, you know what, like we'll be supportive of what you want to do and who you truly are. So, you know, I'm sure they probably weren't proud of me to be sketching sneakers during, you know, social studies, but they encouraged me to send them to Nike, and I got the leather back, and you know, the rest is history. And I,
what did the letter say? Because you must have this committed to memory.
Yeah, I mean, I think they hit on like three bullet points, and it was basically the first one was like, we don't accept designs that don't have a patent or are patent pending. We like have a dedicated design team that is like, you know, researching and constantly developing.
Yeah, it takes a lot of work to come up with a shoe that bad.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, man.
Tell me I'm wrong and I'll take it back.
Swoosh.
Tell me I'm wrong and I'll take
Swoosh.
It back.
Hey, this is, I can't.
He's blushing now, but he's not saying anything. You could run for office now, but anyway.
No, I mean, and then the last thing was like, I hope that you continue to support Nike products. And I think, you know, obviously I saved the leather. And when GQ first like kind of discovered us, I did an interview with them, and it was like a written interview, and Aaron, my business partner, who helps me out with everything, was like out of town, so I was doing it myself. And so I called my mom, and I was like having my mom kind of help me with this interview. And she goes, well, you know, I have that Nike letter that you got when you were like, you know, 7 or 8 years old. And I was like, wait, what? And she goes, I saved the letter. You don't remember that? And I said, oh my God, I think, actually, you know what? I kind of remember. She goes, here, I'll fax it over to you. And she sent it to me, and I was like, oh my God. So I called the people at GQ. I said, hey, I actually have this letter from when I was like 7 years old that is like a letter they sent back to me about, you know, designs I was submitting to them back then. And yeah, it was, you know, instantly became like a pretty interesting wrinkle in like, you know, my story and I guess just like proof of the fact that like this has really been like a lifelong passion, really been like who I've been my entire life.
Is your way of communication now, but like visually and through talking to people, is your way, is that because of your dyslexia? Is that part of it? Is that you're really where you connect with people?
Yeah, I think, you know, like one of the scariest things that you could ever ask me to do would be to read out loud. Like if you were to ask me to like read a passage right now, I'd just be terrified. Like I just really struggle with that and spelling. And like, you know, I try to avoid emails like it's the plague. But as a result, I felt like maybe an added sense of freedom when I was a kid to speak, you know, in public because, hey, I can handle this as long as I don't have to read it, right? So, I think I really, there was like other areas in creativity and expressing myself that were maybe heightened because I had to overcompensate for what I lacked. I don't know. You know, I don't want to try and psychoanalyze myself, but I definitely think that I focus more attention on artistic endeavors and more cultural experiences than I did, like, studying.
Wow. My guest who talks through his streetwear is fashion designer John Elliott. It's the treatment. But I do think that's a big part of it, you know? And there's so many, you're talking about downtown LA, but there's so many denim brands that have come and gone since you got started.
Right.
I think about how many denim brands were in San Francisco. You know, you're fighting against Self Edge and all these who are doing things that are all in their way, and this is all great stuff, but they're kind of the take on Levi's. You're doing something very different from that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that was probably why early on Simon was like, you know, as a friend, probably a little bit concerned that like we were going to have a tough time. I mean, to be completely honest with you, we were like way underfunded when we launched. And we were, you know, also trying to launch like a pretty ambitious collection.
And you are launching a collection rather than just a couple pieces.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say it was a collection because it was just the first season. It was just denim jersey for T-shirts and French Terry. So, you know, it was.
But even using French Terry at that time was a pretty big departure from what other people were doing.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, we packaged it as like a basics line. And I think that because it had like a pretty strong point of view and it was a very contemporary point of view that had street elements, I think people were, you know, they hadn't seen anything like it before. And that's why it caught on immediately. New York was instantly our number one market. Like we were just, it exploded in New York. And, you know, from there, once you have like kind of a, I guess, nucleus of people that are really like setting their taste level, like, okay, this is what I'm wearing, and just kind of expanded. Then LA got big. And then once LA, you know, once it was big in LA and New York, then it kind of like started to trickle out everywhere else.
And I have to say, I'm excited about something I don't own because I slept on it. And I guess the only place I had it was Mr. Porter, where those Nikes that you, yeah. the Vandal you just did this season.
Yeah. So that's a like full circle, right? So having the opportunity to work with Nike.
How'd that come about?
Yeah, so we got brought to Nike by a friend and somebody who was an early adopter to the brand, which is LeBron James. And
I didn't quite hear that name. Who is that? I think I know that name from somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know how he started to find pieces. Actually, I do know. There was a store that we sold to in Cleveland.
Cleveland, of course.
Yeah, and one of the kids that he grew up with was like kind of the manager and buyer for that store. So I think he started to float him some of our stuff. And then once he started wearing our stuff, A, we were shocked that it would fit him and he looked so good in it. But we just kind of started to develop like a...
But he's kind of your ideal person.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. A, like, you know, a person who has like a worldly view, who is athletic and is, you know, constantly outside their comfort zone, constantly traveling, constantly on the move, extremely athletic. Like that's the type of person that I really identify with. I mean, that's my life. That's what I, you know, that's really what I embody. LeBron is like the perfect person for the brand. So he brought us into Nike, and then Nike kind of, I think, identified us as someone who, you know, was worthy of collaborating with. And the first shoe I knew I wanted to work on was the Vandal because I used to skate in the Vandal. And so the last collection we did, which was called Stretch the Floor, which is in like stores right now, we debuted that during New York Fashion Week, and it was like literally a dream come true, like to see, you know, a shoe that like was so influential on my childhood, but then was like kind of redesigned and modernized by me.
It's a different take on it because the Vandal's a pretty simple shoe.
Right.
But you did what you do, which is to sort of like take really interesting fabrication, as you were saying, like using really interesting pieces to build it with. So it's like I shudder to say this to you, John. I'm embarrassed. It's kind of a high fashion take on it. I mean, because you see it, you go, oh, that's what a really cool version of Vandal looked like.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, it's just, you know, you kind of put it through our lens, which is like try and clean the lines up a little bit, slim it down, you know, add a couple details that it didn't have before and really just give it a contemporary feel. And we did that. And luckily enough, the response was, you know, it was massive. Like it was much bigger than I had ever anticipated. you know, kind of is like a new like wrinkle in our story. And it's great because, again, it's super autobiographical and it's a shoe that I wear every single day. And yeah, and then it's also like the realization of a dream, you know, the fact that I was sending letters to Nike when I was 7 years old. And now to say I have my own Nike shoe, like, you know, without sounding corny, like, it, you know, it's like the American dream. Like, it's pretty cool.
I wouldn't know. I've only seen photographs of it. Anyway, so but what's interesting about all this to me is that going back to all these pieces, using French terry, that's a kind of a new wrinkle on the shirting piece. You know, all these things you've done have been basically what can I do to make this feel different but still feel classic?
Yeah, I think, you know, man, I haven't talked about this in a long time, but when we started the company with $30,000, and which is like nothing, it was my, you know, really my dad, myself, and Aaron, my business partner, like put up, you know, enough money to like give this thing a chance to succeed, we thought. And everyone we talked to said like, you're crazy, there's no chance. And so we could really only invest in those three fabrications. And I listened to this interview with the famous boxer, Bernard Hopkins. And he talked about, he I don't know how many years he served in prison. I want to say it was like 7 or 8. And he talked about prison innovation and how prisoners cope with life through innovation in order to just get through the day. And he talked about literally stealing a piece of bread at breakfast and then stealing a piece of cheese at lunch and then stealing another piece of bread at dinner and hiding them. And then when lights would go down, he built like a little oven out of like a shoeboxand some tinfoil.
So
he'd make himself a grilled cheese sandwich every night before he went to sleep, and how that would get him through every day, and how, like, you know, prisoners innovate with nothing. And it was like, not that, you know, the sediment of what, like, you know, what it's like to live in prison was the inspiration, more just like, hey, look, you're not working for anyone right now. You're working for yourself. Like, you, yes, you may have like a limited set of resources, but do more with them. Like, what can you do that hasn't been done that is also like wearable and also like, you know, represents you?
Because I still think that what's so interesting about it too, that it's all these things that are, what's missing? I mean, for somebody like me, who, oh, this is something that when I see it, I go, why didn't somebody think of this earlier? and it's almost like some part of that is for you. It's like, this should have been out there. It was one of the reasons I want to put this out there, because it should be out there now.
Right.
But does part of that come from just being an athlete and knowing that you basically have to be able to perform, knowing what you have to do, that kind of belief in yourself?
That, and I think just, you know, like, I think when you're dyslexic, you just constantly problem solving. You're constantly like finding new ways to like achieve what you need to get done. So it might not always be like the traditional path that a person would take to get to the final destination, but you get there. And like once you've kind of like, you know, done that enough times, you just kind of have this maybe unrealistic like self-belief that like you can kind of figure it out. And that was kind of my approach, was, you know what, like I think I can do this. I think I have a point of view on how I want to dress, and it's not represented right now in the marketplace. Let me see if I can find the right people and the right materials to help me build this. And that's really, you know, where I think I've been most fortunate, is like the people that I work with are so incredibly talented. And, you know, I feel super thankful and lucky that I have had people in my life that have helped support those ideas and help get us there together, because it's been a ton of fun.
I can't believe we're out of time. You got to come back and do the show again.
I would love to.
My guess is the designer, John Elliott, his stuff is insanely cool, but don't listen to me, listen to LeBron James. John, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you. No, true honor. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Our recording engineer, who also mixes the show, is Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake White, who's associate producer. I'm not cool enough to wear his stuff, but I try anyway. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps. Or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
Hey,
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.